Okay, so today is Wednesday, October 21st, 2009, and our topic tonight is masculine, feminine, which I'll be getting into in a few minutes. But first, as usual, does anyone have a comment or a question about meditation tonight or in general or anything else? Greg?
I have anything else.
You mentioned we're going to do something new in January, and you talk about maybe doing something as a group by different ideas. And something Sylvia does, and I wondered if we could do that, is she has, we pick a date, like the first Wednesday or second Wednesday of the month, and everybody whose birthday it is, we raise their hand and we all sing happy birthday to them. So it's kind of, or we can bring cake that day. And the reason I mention that, we could start that in January, but we could start it tonight because it's Rick's birthday. And if there's anybody else who has a birthday in the month of October.
Any other October birthdays, I hope.
Good.
All right, I like that.
And so we could do this, though, every month.
Okay, good. Could you start us tonight?
I'll start us tonight, but I didn't bring a cake, but I brought little chewies.
Oh, that's good. So we have three of us, three October Libra Scorpio types. Okay, good.
Happy birthday to us. Happy birthday, dear Ba-ba-da-da. Happy birthday to you.
Great, thank you.
So we'll be our new tradition, like the first or second Wednesday.
That's very good, Betsy.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I knew you had a mean streak. I just didn't know where it was. It is interesting, though. It is a wonderful idea, but it does immediately, at least for some of us, make one think about the whole notion of taking birth, right? It's your birthday. You took birth, as it were. You were born, something like that. And it's interesting to reflect on it without getting all metaphysical about it, but just what an incredible opportunity to have a human life. I mean, it's an imperfect one, to be sure, but wow, just how blessed, to me, at least, that's how I see it, how grateful for that incredible opportunity. As you know, I think a fair amount about the brain, and the more one knows about it, the more you just realize, oh my gosh, we've inherited the most incredible piece of equipment on the planet by orders of magnitude more than anything else, and it was just given to us on the day we were conceived. And then it got built out and was pretty up and operational on the day we were born. And then over the next 10, 20 years, it really matured into its full capabilities. And it's been humming away ever since. And I didn't earn that. Did you? I don't know anybody who earned that. I didn't earn it.
Parents.
Well, they didn't. You know what I mean? They didn't. It was like the whole thing. They might have helped tune the machinery and give it some good nutrients maybe and all the rest of that. But what an incredible, amazing thing. So. You know, one of the classic reflections in Buddhism is on the four reflections, the kind of wonder and the great gift of a human birth. So I just invite you to take that into account yourself, to hold your own life as a really precious thing. It's like if you had a bird in your hand and, you could crush it or you could set it free, and feed it and nourish it every day, what would you do with that bird in your hand? Your life is that same. It's in your hands. What it will be is in your power more than anyone else's on the planet, right? And it's a life that you have more power over than any other life on the planet. So keeping that in mind every day of the year, not just the day you were born, pretty good thing to do. Okay. Partly because I have a lot I want to cover, maybe we'll move into masculine, feminine. Okay? So the larger context is that we've been considering the broad domain of relationships this year, and both as a field of practice and as a way to practice. Practice being a kind of general term for nourishing happiness and love and wisdom, and also containing and controlling and getting rid of, ultimately, the causes of suffering and hate and ignorance. So that's what practice is. So we practice in lots of different ways. And a domain of practice and a mode of practice is relationship. Okay, so in that context, how could we get through the year without talking about masculine and feminine? And so I'm going to introduce that subject tonight, and then we'll kind of play around with it in different sorts of ways over the next few weeks. First, I want to kind of clarify some terms. The subject matter is fairly loaded. It's often been politicized. First, I'd like to separate masculine-feminine from male-female. Right? And to do that in particular, I'm going to kind of move away from the terminology masculine-feminine, which has so many associations to it, and talk much more tonight and in general, using as a kind of proxy the terms from the Chinese tradition of yin and yang, yin being feminine, yang being masculine. So that's the main way I'm going to talk about that tonight. So in the teachings of Buddhism, there is the recognition that there are distinctions. In other words, you know, Diana is different from Rick, all right? This hand is different from that hand. The mouth is different from the ear, as every toddler slowly learns when it's eating mashed potatoes. All right? Mouth, ear, different. It matters. On the other hand, in a more absolute sense, there's a recognition that those distinctions are true at one level, but at a deeper level, they're artificial, they're constructed. They're not absolute. In other words, nothing has any absolute self-existence, whether an ear or a mouth, right? Or yin or yang, masculine or feminine. So we're holding both those things. In other words, we're going to talk about differences in a container, hopefully, of a larger recognition of interdependence and connection, and the suffering that arises when we get trapped in differences and distinctions, rather than using them as a kind of raft, you know, a vehicle to get us across the river of suffering. Okay. With that disclaimer for the record, let's talk about differences. So, classically, a distinction is made between a kind of a collection of matched pairs that cluster in two ways. So we have active, inert. Could have used the word passive. It's not a fair word. It has negative connotations, though, to some extent. So I'll use more often the term inert. We could talk about penetrating or receiving, conceptual or concrete, embodied, felt. We could talk about heaven or earth. Right? These are the classic paired distinctions. Anybody have any other examples of that? These pairings? Yeah?
Hot, heat and cold.
Okay, I don't know if I would put them in these clusters, but you could, you know, because there's energy in both of them. But
it's opposite. It's
yeah, that's true. But if yeah, you're totally right. I mean, in that sense, you're totally right. I could have been clearer. What I really mean is in the general domain of masculine, feminine, as we conventionally use those words in the culture, or yang and yin, you know, what are there any other matched pairs that would maybe fit in that domain? Yeah.
Positive and negative, but negative in the vein of receptive.
Yeah, okay, great, good. That's right, foreground, background. Maybe that's what you were saying in a graphic designer sense or a visual sense.
Positive and negative, like
yeah.
In the
magnet? Yeah, okay, great, super.
Sun and moon.
What?
Sun and moon.
Sun and moon, that's a classic one, right?
Right. Thinking, feeling?
Sure, classic one again, different modes. Okay, so you can see there are different modes, different ways of being. A little later on, I'll invite you to think about in your own life in what ways it would serve you to be more active, more penetrating, and more tightly focused. And I'll also ask you to consider how it might serve you in life to be more inert or more receptive, or more panoramically aware. Right? Yang, masculine, in the first case, yin, feminine, in the second case. Both are important. One is not more important than the other. People tend to be tilted strongly in one direction or another. Those tiltings often load, obviously, on gender, but a lot of that is a social construction, right? It's kind of made up by society, and it's important to not get trapped by it. Okay, so you see the background of it, you know? So now I want to talk about this in a more specifically Buddhist framework, and then we'll bring it home to our own lives. A little bit of history. This may be familiar to some, not so familiar to others. So historically, Siddhartha Gautama taught around 500 years BCE, before the Common Era, or BC before Christ. And in other words, about 2,500 years ago. He wandered India. His teachings were remembered and passed down from person to person, undoubtedly with some editing and a little bit of freelance interpretation, addition and subtraction by various people. But they were more or less a generally accepted body of material and oral tradition that was then written down starting several centuries after he died. And ultimately, the earliest surviving written record was laid down probably right around the time of Jesus. In other words, around 500 years after the Buddha died was the earliest surviving written record. So that's the written record that forms the basis for what's called the Pali Canon. Pali is the language it was written in. Canon is a body of information. So when you see things like the Majjhima Nikaya, or you see a book called In the Buddha's Words, that's about the original foundational teachings that are associated with the Buddha most directly. That canon, by the way, interestingly, includes some talks by other people, including one of the regarded most, the pithiest, profound, to the bullseye talks by a woman. So it's not just men in those talks, mainly men, but not entirely men. So that's the Pali Canon, right? That's the original foundation. But of course, like any religion, if we could call it that, or spiritual practice, it had its different sects, it had its different divisions, it had people who kind of were prone more toward one kind of practice or another. There's a lot of activity with Buddhism. And one of the main sort of distillations of those, you could say, revisions or additions, perhaps, really came in at the birth of what's called the Mahayana tradition. And that birth was not a single event. It was really a rolling birth, if you will. It was a really long gestation and delivery. But finally, the baby pretty much came out around 6 centuries or so after the Buddha died with the beginnings of the Mahayana tradition and what are called the Paramita Suttas. This is a collection of writings. No one knows who wrote them. It is said in the folklore that they were produced by the Buddha, but they were too advanced for the time. So the king of the Nagas, who are sea serpents, I guess, guarded them for centuries at the bottom of a deep lake until mankind was ready to receive them. Whatever. But bottom line, there's this amazing body of literature that somebody produced, or many somebodies probably, that includes the Lotus Sutta, the Diamond Heart Sutta, the Diamond Sutta, and a whole body of material that's really the foundation of Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism. So, which the majority of Buddhists in the world, perhaps even in America as well, practice. So it's a profound tradition with many, many additions to the core teachings, the original teachings of the Buddha. If you hear the term Theravadin, which is the Theravadin tradition, is the one that Spirit Rock is in, or IMS, Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. So when I was mainly trained in and developed in, if you will, marinated in, that word Theravadin means the way of the elders. So it's the notion that these are the elders. This is the original teaching for better or for worse. So interestingly, in the Paramita teachings or the Mahayana teachings, there is this notion that started to emerge of a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva is someone who is highly awakened but gives up complete enlightenment, complete arahantship, which means that there are no longer any causes for rebirth, but continues to hold on to birth just a little bit to be reborn again and again and again to help other beings, you know, come to awakening. And a bodhisattva has what are called paramitas, perfections. And there are 6 perfections, then 4 got added, so there are 10 perfections. Last year we talked about the perfections. I think next year I'll return to that subject some. And so that's a paramita is a perfection. And one of the perfections is wisdom. Some might consider the highest perfection is wisdom. And the word for wisdom in Sanskrit is prajna, P-R-A-J-N-A. So we have the prajna paramita, right? Paramitas are the perfections of an awakened being. We all have these to some extent, but they are perfected in a bodhisattva. And the most perfect of the perfections, if you will, is wisdom or prajna. Then the question becomes, what really is the embodiment of that great perfection? What is the nature of that great wisdom? In the teachings of the Mahayana, they really stressed emptiness. In other words, they took the Buddha's original teachings of anatta. You'll recall that he said there were 3 characteristics to existence: dukkha, anatta, and anicca. Dukkha is suffering, anatta is not self, anicca is impermanence. So if you look out in the world, you see 3 things. You see that everything's changing. You see that that nothing has an absolute self-arising existence. In other words, everything arises due to conditions, including the apparent self. And there is suffering, particularly when people don't recognize those first 2 characteristics. All right? That original notion of anatta, in other words, that there's interdependence, and in particular, anatta was a critique of the Hindu notion of an atman. Atman means not. Not atman. In other words, not an eternal soul that bounces from life to life like an irreducible pearl that just is and never changes, okay, without reference to conditions. The Buddha fiercely critiqued that. All right. So that's the background here. So then what the Mahayanans did is they took this notion of, you know, there is no soul, which was sort of the heart of the Buddhist critique, and, you know, in this idea that things are connected to each other, and they really took it all the way to the point that a deep, deep, deep consideration of the integration and the interdependence of all things. And for them, that was seeing that clearly was the pinnacle of wisdom. Okay? So we have this perfection, wisdom, which is the ultimate perfection, and the essence of wisdom is seeing how everything is connected, right? Intimately connected. Well, who was the icon of that highest wisdom? It was a female figure. And in Buddhism, this was a radical move to bring a female figure in as the icon, the absolute representation of this highest quality of wisdom. And at that point, and of course you have to put this in the background of profound patriarchy, right? Intense resistance, which alas is still present in Buddhism today in many quarters, to allowing women to completely be equals to men as teachers in Buddhism. But to consider that the embodiment of the highest perfection was female was an extraordinary move. And it became a resource, an ally, and a comfort to many, many women practitioners. even to this day, I don't know if you get the Spirit Rock, I think it's their quarterly newsletter or something like that. The most, actually, I think maybe not the most recent one, but quite recently there was one in which a number of female teachers were talking about Prajnaparamita and the importance of that. Because Spirit Rock, unlike probably any other Buddhist center in the country, or most Buddhist centers certainly, has in the front, you know, where you face, so you would be facing here, if you may recall, behind the teachers are two major figurines, a figurine representing the Buddha and a figurine representing Prajnaparamita, the male and the female, right? If you will, masculine and feminine, as two absolutely central, co-equal. Not the figurines are equally sized, right? It's not...
higher than the Buddha.
That's right, it will. Right, that's really funny.
They have them on little biases, so that there has to be some intention there.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's really funny.
About like that.
Yeah, not a surprise.
So,
there you go. Her do. Well, actually, the Buddha has this do as well, so you never know. Anyway, so, and to be, you know, a woman in a tradition in which most of the teachers are male, the primary teacher is male, the Buddha, if you will, and which has a lot of, if you will, yang qualities to it. It's about discerning, penetrating clarity, mental clarity. It's about, you know, if you will, ideas that ultimately have to be deeply understood. In that larger context, to have a female figure as the embodiment of wisdom is just incredibly supportive. So it's interesting that, for example, you know, the jewel in the lotus, right? That's a traditional notion, the idea that there's wisdom and compassion. The two wings of practice, wisdom and compassion. I originally thought that, of course, the lotus would be compassion and it would be feminine, and that wisdom would be more masculine, right? Well, actually, the bright and shining embodiment of wisdom in that image is feminine, is seen as feminine. And wisdom is feminine, and compassion is actually masculine. And it's interesting that one of the main icons of compassion, I'm going to mispronounce this, Avalokiteshvara, is masculine. So it's really interesting to take the traditional notion that women, feminine, are really heartfelt and gushy and lovey-lovey, and men are more penetrating and wise and intelligent. So we'll let the women take care of the home, the hearth, and all the rest. Men will do business and go to war. See how that's turned out in the world. It's turned on its head in Buddhism. It's actually the feminine that's penetrating and intelligent and wise and clear through this deep understanding that everything is connected to everything else and nothing arises on its own. And the masculine is this kind of heartfelt embracing with compassion that's moved by the suffering of others. Isn't that a very powerful inversion? And it's really worth looking at in our own lives, and particularly in terms of our conventional beliefs about the nature of masculine and feminine in our own place. Right? In other words, it's interesting to imagine as a man taking on your leading characteristic as a heartfelt, empathic movement by the suffering of others. Right? That would be a shift for a lot of us guys. Go the other way, to imagine that your nature as a woman is first and foremost this profound intelligence about the interconnectedness of everything. Wow.
That one doesn't surprise me.
That one doesn't surprise me either. Okay. So you see the backstory there? It's really kind of interesting. I wanted to sort of lay out some of these themes. We have a lot of unpacking and playing to do as we go along. But now, if you will, I'd like to suggest we do a little practice, and then we talk about it. Okay? And the practice is, you can always sit it out. I'll ask you to form pairs in a minute. Pick an A, pick a B. A's will go first, as usual. You know my ways. And what I'll ask you to do is one person will mainly listen. The A's will start by being the talker in the very beginning. And for 2 minutes, the talker, if you will, and I hope you will talk about how you would be served by becoming more or being more penetrating, active, and focal in your attention. Eyes locked on the prize, right? Driving to the end zone. Okay? And then after that, 2 minutes have gone by, I'll ask you also to reflect for 2 minutes on how you would be served by becoming or being more inert, more receptive, more panoramic and wide open in your view in terms of what you're taking into account. Okay? And I'll give you a little instructions just before we start. All right? So you can always sit it out. So how about you grab a partner? Let's dive in. Grab a partner. And I'll move you through it. I ask your forgiveness in advance for my camp counselor-like signals. So if you do not have a partner and want one, raise your hand, please. Oh my gosh, great. Everybody's good. Grab a partner, turn and face your partner. You can go outside if you want. Okay, figure out who's an A and who's a B. All right, so get ready. So A's, you're going to start by thinking, how would I be served and how could I do it concretely by becoming more active, more penetrating, and more focused? Begin. Start wrapping it up. Okay, A's, it's still your turn, A's. Now go to, how would it serve you to be, and here are the words, sort of inert, receptive, and panoramic. Begin. Thank you.
Start wrapping it up. Okay. Thank you. All right, bees, your turn. So you're going to start out by asking yourself, how could you be served by becoming more, three words, active, penetrating, and focused? Begin.
I just got a week's retreat with Stephen and Cameron. So. I'm floating.
That's good. You look all floaty. Happy to see you floaty.
How are you doing?
Just great. Yeah, just riding away.
You're going to have to do a lot of touring the book opening?
A lot of it through radio. Mm-hmm. A lot of it through radio.
Yeah.
From my home. Start wrapping it up. Okay, bees, now the yin side of it. In other words, how could it serve you to be or become more inert, receptive, and panoramic? Begin.
Thank you.
start wrapping it up. Come back, come back. Ollie, Ollie, auction. Free, free, free. Come back. All right, please come back. How was that? What'd you see? What'd you experience? What'd you learn? What happened? Please. Sure, you.
I experienced that you really need to have both. You need to have a balance of both in your life, and you know, each one complements each other, and you know, everything in moderation.
All right, good. Thank you. Thank you. Good. Yeah, great. Yeah.
I was noticing I had a tough time with the first round because I feel that I am very penetrating and active, and what was the third one?
Focused.
Focused. To the point of being imbalanced, and so I couldn't think of a way that I wanted to be more of that.
That's the takeaway then. Great. Yeah.
And then I really wanted to, I've been really working at cultivating the opposite in my life and feeling that that's where the joy comes from.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Jeff.
Two things. The first was the idea or the two symbols, one of, you know, dolphin going in and out of the water, swimming and then flying free in the air and going back down. Also an artist working on a painting, you know, stepping back, getting the big picture, seeing how things fit in, and then going into work on the details. And just about any labor that you do can do with a bit of, you know, both in and out. But in the second was the thought that in some ways it's a trick question, because either side, in order to do them well, requires that you give up your aversions, your grasping, and your delusion.
Yeah.
If you're aversive, then you'll be afraid to go out there and be penetrating, or you'll be afraid to stand back and be receptive.
Yeah.
So both can stand from letting go.
Thank you. Wonderful.
Did I hear you say, did I miss it? Did you say, Avalokiteshvara? And what
is
that?
Oh, it's an icon. Yeah. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's seen as an actual, if you will, spirit entity of some kind. If nothing else, it's a symbol for compassion.
I thought it was the god that could be masculine or feminine or change from one to the other.
I don't know. Maybe you're thinking of Janus, you know, the Greek god. I don't know. Latin, I don't know. Maybe Kuan Yin is the feminine version of that. But the larger point I wanted to make, not to get into the detail of it, is just it's interesting to imagine that a representation of compassion would be masculine. You know, it just helps us be freer with these distinctions as well. Yeah. So, Jan?
I was going to say that the descriptor of the feminine that I was so hot on was in there. And, you know, I guess I kind of have a question for you about that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, receptive, soft, inert.
Yeah. No, it's great. So I was searching for, I'm happy to have a better word. I actually hold it as the idea of patience or non-doing. I mean, we're so addicted to this fire of doing. It's the coolness of non-doing. Of waiting. There's a, in my therapy office, I have a little card I got somewhere with a statement from Lao Tzu. It says something like, one who is wise knows when to allow the waters to settle, you know, so that the truth emerges. It's good for a therapist, right? But that's what I meant by it. You know, there's a time where... I was thinking of penetrating versus receiving, so I didn't use the word receptive. But I think there's...
Instead of inert,
what was
accepting.
You could say accepting. I really mean stillness.
That's a total difference.
Stillness. Yeah.
It's a
pause between the breath. You know, there's the end breath.
Oh,
and the
lovely.
End breath, and then there's the pause.
Yeah.
And so it's that stillness, that pause between the breath.
Yeah, great. That was a lovely way to put it. You heard it, right? The pause.
Again.
Say it louder, if you will.
Oh, I
Susan?
Was just saying it's the, like the pause between the breath. So you have an in breath and the out breath, but then you have the pause that's in between that.
Yeah.
Good.
Well, I remember this thing I learned from physics a long time ago. Like, you throw something up, anything that goes up, there's a moment of perfect stillness, you know, at the top. Yeah.
I think of inertness being non-reactive. In chemistry, it means that something that inert is inert.
Yeah.
It doesn't connect with anything. And I think of this.
Tell us the name of the. Tell us all the name of the group of elements that are inert and non-reactive.
It's
the noble gases. Oh, yeah. Inert is good. This nerd is good. Yeah, keep going.
The other reflection I had on there is that there's a quality in meditation after, well, in samadhi, where you get to this place of just absolutely not moving, completely rooted and grounded and totally present, and there's nothing that's going to move you.
Yeah.
And it relates to that quality in chemistry of that art. But I guess I usually think of that as a Buddha quality, or maybe a more masculine quality. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, and yet, the other side of the coin is, meditation is one of the most central, if not the most central practice in Buddhism, and yet, it's a very receptive practice of just sitting and receiving what comes, and hoping for what it is.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Did you want to, that gesture, right, of settling, right? Just what you did there.
It's not the right word for female. It is a calmness and peace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
When you say inner, it's
misleading. Oh, sure. Yeah. And I'm happy to have a better word if maybe we'll have nominations for the one word. I like stillness. Maybe that's that's my leading candidate now.
And
I,
so thank you. We can raise
what?
At the third of the month. The, like the third Wednesday of the month, we can bring that up.
You're right, that's exactly right. Better words. Okay, we'll move to an end. Diane?
Yeah, I don't know. It really bothers me, the word inert. Because the whole idea that I'm hearing about the feminine, which to me is not stillness, and it's not breathing. It's not the pause between the breaths.
No.
If you think of our cave people ancestors, the warrior was out there maybe killing the animals to bring home food, but there was the feminine, the mother at home holding the baby, nurturing the baby, feeding the baby. She was not inert. She wasn't inert birthing it, and she's not inert holding it, nurturing it, and listening for the cries to see if it's okay or something's wrong with it. I feel the feminine is active, and Avalokiteshvari in the embodiment of compassion in the masculine, or whether it's Kuan Yin in the feminine, they're both listening to the suffering of others, and if they hear the crying of one who's suffering, they're able to get up quickly and go to the suffering. That's feminine as well as, you know, masculine. I don't see that one is more active or the other. I don't think passive might be the best word either, but certainly receptive, taking in, but it's active listening.
Sure.
It's not dead.
Yeah, great.
And that's why inert bothers me, because it feels much more without energy.
Uh-huh.
You know, I find the feminine very energetic, very active. In a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
And they're interchangeable. The feminine can be the warrior, and the masculine can be the nurturer.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, searching for the right words to embody these energies, really, they are energies, is really crucial.
Yeah, I'm very glad you said that. In part because it illustrates, I think,
importance of sort of moving past masculine and feminine as a distinction, because it is so incredibly genderized, right? I mean, the examples you gave of the feminine were all female. And so that's why I said that in the very beginning, I was going to try to step outside that frame. And even using language like yin and yang, which is sort of the Chinese version of that. Again, it's a really tricky business. I will say, I think that it's also the case that whether you're male or female, you have masculine and feminine tendencies, or whether you're male or female, you have the capacity on the one hand to be active or still. You have the capacity to penetrate or to receive, right? And you have the capacity to focus in or open out wide. And I find that those are distinct. Those are very distinct. And people tend to have strengths at one or the other. And sometimes those strengths load on gender and sometimes they don't. But I think that's really what I invite you to consider, particularly in terms of your own practice. So rather than, you know, time, how about we do this? How about we just focus on what I think of as the embodiment part, which is often the weak suit in practice. In other words, speaking for myself, I tend to be very good at understanding and intellect and, you know, clear view, right view. But to really have practice sink deeply in. You know, the instructions I gave in the meditation? Receive the breath, receive sensations, receive sights and thoughts and sounds and wants and memories and plans, you know, like the earth receives the rain. To have that kind of embodied, felt quality. So rather than get twirled into a whirlwind of words, why don't we just sit quietly for a couple of minutes, let all this sort of sink in, let the waters settle, let the sediments settle, and we're going to come back. We have a number of at-bats for this. Where the word will have many opportunities to spin around. Although I'm hoping that we'll come in and just paint one night. Okay, so let's just sit for a couple minutes and then we'll end. Feeling what it feels like in the body to have thoughts spinning in the mind, or perhaps to feel unsettled. And also feeling in the body what it feels like to have the spaciousness in which that activity arises and passes away. Feeling the floor with your feet, grounded. May our sincere efforts tonight help free ourselves and others from suffering and its causes. Thank you. May you be served by all paired opposites.
real and imagined.